Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders Fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper. And I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland, and I'm your hostess for this evening. And as always, we are brought to you through the good offices of www.patriotfamilies.com, a great group of people who believe that the most important thing is to do what is right and not what is easy. In our current climate in this nation, we are facing a critical election in November. An election that will decide the direction of this nation for at least the next 4 years. And we are more deeply divided over that direction than I can remember in my 65 years of paying attention to what was going on in our political world. Tonight's topic is related, both directly and indirectly, to the critical nature of this year's presidential election. Our topic is public schools as surrogate parent. In essence, what we are looking at in November is a decision between individual liberty and individual responsibility, free market capitalism, limited government, and the right of an individual to be an individual, and the nanny state, European socialism, that will make sure that we think the politically correct thought, act in the politically correct way, and are totally dependent upon a huge government for every breath we take, and thus totally controlled. Our public schools are a weapon in this fight for the freedom of America. For the last 30 years, more and more parents have handed over their parenting duties to the public education system. Schools now provide free meals, breakfast and lunch. They provide daycare after school. They provide counseling for practically everything. They decide whether or not a student passes or fails, not based on his or her accumulation of the required skills, but on whether or not they need special accommodations, whether or not they behaved well, whether or not they're disabled and thus not required to meet the same requirements academically as everybody else in class, and yet have also told us that all of our students are alike and can progress at the same rate and achieve the same academic skill level in a chronological school year. The picture is very, very clear, ladies and gentlemen. Too many parents have bought into the idea that their responsibilities for their children, morally, ethically, academically, intellectually, and spiritually, end when their child turns 5 and is handed over to the state to educate. In some schools in this nation, kindergarten children are being told that they should explore homosexuality before they decide which gender they wish to portray in their sexual lives. Our schools have anti-bullying programs, because Facebook and technology are now used to make that person who is quote-unquote different so uncomfortable that they kill themselves. Our schools are busy telling parents that once their child has been handed over to the school system, the federal government will take care of teaching them everything they need to know in life. Not just the academics they need to be a successful citizen, not just the common courtesy our society requires of people who are in the same room together for a period of time, but political ideology, lack of spiritual expression, don't mention moral values because that might offend someone. In essence, what our public schools are doing is recreating our children into happy clones, all of whom will be quite glad to stand in line with their handout for the next federal dole and not politely when they're told who to vote for by the people they're voting for. And they will do it because they are being taught dependency. They are being taught that they are not responsible for their own actions, and that it's somebody else's fault that they didn't study for their test, or they didn't listen in class, or that they can't quite make it to school more than once a week. There is no way that we can guarantee that a child will be born into a caring, loving family. That would be taking the nanny state to 1984 levels, and I am not advocating that. However, neither am I advocating that all families are inept and incapable of teaching their children ethics and morality, and should have any home lessons completely dumped at the front door of a school and be redesigned into the image of the progressive liberal educational system. I have seen so many children who have difficulties with certain aspects of learning, who once they realize that, yeah, it's going to be harder for you to learn this, but it doesn't mean you can't, was the truth, put forth an effort and did remarkably well. My own husband is one of them. That is not what our public schools are telling our kids. They are telling them that you are a poor victim and we are going to protect you from yourself. We're going to level the playing field and make sure you take home a report card full of A's, even though you're only reading on second grade level in eighth grade, because we don't want to hurt your feelings. Public schools prepare children for the real world about as well as a blind, deaf, mute, and dry mother cat nurtures her kittens. They provide garbage. the good teachers who staff our public schools, and believe me, ladies and gentlemen, there are more good ones than bad ones, very rarely stay in education, in public education, for longer than 5 years, purely and simply because they are inundated with ideology and data and paperwork and mandates and federal requirements to the point they can no longer teach. If they tell the truth, they are probably going to be fired because whatever they say is going to be dubbed politically incorrect or hurtful or racist or whatever by practically everybody. There is a controversy going on right now. For those of you who pay attention to Glenn Beck and his radio shows, TV shows, and The Blaze, over David Barton's historical treatise on Jefferson called The Jefferson Lies. There is a gentleman, a Mr. Throckmorton, who has called Barton to count because his so-called interpretation of some of Jefferson's statements in notes and letters and public papers are interpreted, as I said, by Barton as indicating that Jefferson believed in Christianity. Mr. Throckmorton claims that he did not. And they both use the same pieces of paper to reinforce their opinions. I am not taking sides in this particular argument. Where I find the major difficulty, Mr. Barton is a historian, Dr. Barton. He's also a theologian. Mr. Throckmorton is a psychologist. And he is making one sort of mistake in his interpretation, just as Mr. Barton is making another sort. The psychological interpretation of people who lived in the 19th and 18th centuries by people who think in 21st century ideas, concepts, and behaviors is ridiculous. There is no way that you can describe or understand Thomas Jefferson based on 21st century psychological theory. Most of us who have any degree of intelligence and wit understand that people who lived two centuries ago lived in a world that was very different from ours. And as much as you would like to distill psychological motivation down to a series of mechanistic theories, cause and effect push buttons, you can't do it. Because unless you understand the life experiences of the person you're psychoanalyzing, you have a snowball's chance in the hot piece of coming up with anything close to truth. Dr. Barton's mistake is, like any theologian, he sees through the glass of Christian theology and Christian thinking. He is an evangelical theologian. And because he admires Jefferson, as do most Americans who know anything about the man, he would like to see his beliefs and his approaches as fitting within his own spiritual discipline, because Jefferson did believe in certain aspects of the Christian faith. But like very many intelligent people in this world, he had doubts. He had a big, deep doubt, an intellectual inability to grasp make a part of his belief system, the idea of unity and Trinity. So, as any independent-minded individual, he spoke the truth about what he believed and what he doubted. And this is what our children should be allowed to do. We admire Jefferson, not for his religious beliefs, but for his intellect and his understanding of what our natural rights are. His understanding and belief in the ascendancy of the individual as the hope for government that derives its just powers from the consent of the government. He understood that you cannot have that unless you have an educated, questioning, curious, motivated, lifelong learning population. And the progressive liberal establishment in Washington is doing everything it can to prevent that from happening. Looks like I have a caller on the line. Let me see. It looks like it's my friend Ron Golden. Hello, Ron. Can you hear me?
Miss Terry, I can indeed. I'm doing well.
Great.
I actually called in just to listen, but since you brought me on, of course, I will always take the opportunity to pontificate.
Feel free, dear. You feel free.
You know, exactly what you're explaining, I witnessed today, and it's quite infuriating, and it's one of the reasons why, I believe, the founders established our government in the manner that they did. It's like the old saying, you can't please all the people all the time, and in fact, government shouldn't be there to be pleasing people or providing them with remedy beyond a remedy at law.
Correct.
I had a gentleman, a customer in today, and we were talking and having a very nice conversation, and he brought up politics. And he was talking about Paul Ryan, and I said, you know, it's unfortunate that the people won't get behind an individual who has absolute integrity and wants to follow the rule of law and our Constitution. And he said, well, we don't have anyone like that. And I said, sure we do, Ron Paul. So, of course, he went, oh, he's nuts. And I said, really, how so? And, of course, he went into, you know, his foreign policy. And as I tried to be very delicate, of course, the gentleman's one of my customers.
Understandable.
And so I was asking him for some kind of specific example, and he brought up Syria, what's going on in Syria today, and how tragic it was, and how it just tears him apart to see, you know, 40 children, innocent children, murdered, and nothing needs to be done about it. And I said, well, you know, there's a lot of suffering children right here at home, and I think we should have free health care for everyone. And I think we should have social welfare programs so that everyone's taken care of and no one wants for anything. Now, I said that because I knew he was diametrically opposed to those ideas. But the point is that, you know, you're picking your poison here. So you're feigning this moral outrage over the death of 40 children in Syria, but yet you won't accept any responsibility for those children here at home. I mean, you know, let's face it. Look, dude, the only one you can be responsible for is yourself. And if you have the charity in your heart and want to give to others, then do so out of your own pocket and not out of mine.
And again, bringing it back to Jefferson, if it doesn't pick my pocket or break my arm, fine, go right ahead. And that's one of the founding ideas of this free society. The idea that the moral and ethical values are supposed to be from the individual, not mandated by government. Governments can't impose ethical values. Governments can't understand ethics. Governments are collections of people and agencies and bureaucracies that follow mechanistic rule books about how to administer funds and what specific things they are responsible for. That's it. Our Constitution does not give the federal government the authority to do any of the things that people like your customer or any progressive out there wants it to do. Our founding fathers were not at all in favor of even having treaties with other nations or alliances. Trade was their idea of the best way to get along with their international partners. They did not want alliances. They wanted us to remain independent of, at the time, European infighting, backbiting, and throat-cutting.
Well,
because they
could
see the effects of it.
Right, and I think they recognize that if you become dependent on the production of goods from a foreign source, then you are beholden to them. You're serving a master, and you're enslaving yourself and your population.
And they went through it with England.
And I just don't understand how so many well-meaning, otherwise conservative-minded individuals, when it comes to our military interventionism around the globe, they can't see that that is the same progressive ideology that they fight right here at home being implemented abroad. And they just can't see it. They can't see it for what it is, and they're afraid. They're afraid that the world's going to collapse if we're not the policemen all around the world.
Well, part of it comes from the fact that our history, ever since we became a major mover and shaker in the world about the time of Teddy Roosevelt, has always been that somehow or other we have extrapolated manifest destiny into meaning we are supposed to export democracy to everybody, whether they want it or not. And unfortunately, in many countries, they don't want it because of literacy rates, because of the average educational level, because of the national resources, because of tribal considerations, like in most Islamic countries, Islam is a tribal religion, and you don't have the same understanding of what individual freedom means, because in order to have the kind of representative democracy that we have, you need an educated electorate, and many countries don't have one. We were.
This one doesn't have one.
Tell me about it, dear. I try to make one every day of the year, except summer, and thank God I've had that. But it drives me crazy because I run into the same kind of thing. It's very easy to be compassionate and tearful over poor little children dying in Syria, but the guy down the street who's struggling to buy food and doesn't tell anybody because he knows that it's his responsibility to care for his own family, nobody pays any attention to him because nobody takes the time to know him.
Right.
We have developed what Jefferson called the European city attitude. He was definitely a ruralist. He hated the idea of Americans creating metropolis purely and simply because when you give over to that thinking pattern, you do two basic things that undermine the way this nation runs. Number one, something is always somebody else's problem to fix. And number two, your neighbors aren't neighbors. They're people who live in the same building. He understood that the basic values of the mostly rural colonies, and most of them were, that your neighbor was your neighbor. If you didn't help him when you were in trouble, he wouldn't help you. And along with friends, if we don't hang together, we shall most assuredly hang separately. That understanding has gone the way of the horse and buggy. And it's a sad commentary on what our education system has done. When we teach history, Ron, it's about dates, and it's about the colonists didn't like the idea of being taxed without representation. All these things are true. But there is no investigation of why the things that they fought to establish for us are the right things. It's by rote. It's cleaned up. It's tailored so we get enough Hispanics and African Americans and God knows what else. You know, we focus on Lafayette and von Steuben and Kosciuszko because looky here, these are different ethnic groups. Weren't we wonderful? It doesn't matter where they came from. What matters is the ideal that they were willing to give their lives for, even though they didn't live here. It's not about their ethnicity. It's about the ideal. And that is what is not being taught. And that comes back to the fact that surrogate parenthood is being the mantra of our public schools. I was taught about this stuff at home as well as school. When a teacher brought up an idea like that, an ideal or a moral principle, I talked about it with my parents. If they didn't agree with it, they told me why. If I agreed with it, I told them why. My father believed that the only stupid question was the one you didn't ask. And he taught me that. He taught me that he would always listen to my opinions and ideas and arguments. And if he disagreed with me, he would say so. not because he expected me to always do exactly what he agreed with, but because he believed that's one of the ways in which we learn. If you cannot defend your position, if you cannot back up your argument or your opinion, then he didn't want to hear it. But if you could, and if you had a rational, logical reason for what you were saying, he would accept that. Not agree necessarily, but accept
right.
it. This is what our school is supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be teaching our children the fact they need to know about all of the main branches, history, English, science, and mathematics. And they're supposed to be teaching them how to learn and how to think. Not to think.
Right.
What to think, what to believe, how to lead your life morally and spiritually is the responsibility of parents. Parents, not government. And unfortunately, because we have been blind and we have been apathetic and we have been lazy, we have allowed this to go on for 30 years. And the watershed election that we are facing in November is going to really, I believe, make a huge difference across the board in all of our institutions, governmental or private, because it's such a divergence in ideology. The last time something this big divided us was basically during Wilson's term.
I would definitely agree with you on that. You know, I remember in junior high school when our history teacher was teaching us about the Roman Empire, and mm-hmm. they were talking about the Roman army and, you know, 30,000 men and all the different various people it took and the logistics. And I had a legitimate question. I wanted to know, you know, where did they go to the bathroom?
Uh-huh.
And what did they use for toilet paper? Because I knew they uh-huh. didn't have any. And
yep.
I was in trouble for asking that question. Because that's outside of the norm of the box. But I truly wanted to know. I wasn't trying to be disruptive.
I'd have answered it. And if one of my kids asked me, I will. They went to in barracks, they built latrines. And with toilet paper, whatever material could be found, usually leaves or moss or something of that nature, if they were out in the field. And if they didn't have any, they pretty much went to the baths, which every Roman fortification had, and got clean there.
Yeah, and that would have been a simple answer, but, you know, that was not how it was responded to. And, of course, you know, all the kids were laughing, and you know,
of course
so the teacher
were.
Got upset, and
yeah.
and I was just being disruptive.
Yeah, oh, believe me, dear, I've had a couple of students who could have been you in miniature, and I always answer the questions. And if I don't know the answer, I tell them so, and I try to find it out for them. And those are the kids that generally aren't repeat offenders because they truly weren't being disruptive. We're being thinkers. I'm all for thinking. I like to encourage it. I like to answer a question if a student makes a good, sensible question, a question about something they really want to know. I have been in the business long enough to know and to be able to tell the difference between a smart gluteus maximus and trying to behave like a smart gluteus maximus and a question that somebody really doesn't know and they want to ask because they'd like some more information. Unfortunately, or fortunately, my little tiny jail, I can run pretty much the way I want to. Provided I don't, you know, torture them or set them on the rowing benches or hold them up to ridicule or eat them for lunch, although I've been tempted. But in a regular classroom, there are so many hedges in the way. One of them, of course, is the chronological need to meet state standards, that everybody has to know this by the end of this grade, and if they don't, the teacher's to blame for it. And the idiocy of collaborative classes, where you get the kids who know darn good and well that they don't understand what's going on. They feel isolated by their inability to understand, and they need attention, and they'll take any kind they get, and usually it's being class clown because everybody laughs and look, I'm cool. It's the overall screwed up view of what kids are. They either have an absolutely angelic vision that every one of them wears wings and has a halo and polishes every night before they come to school, which is ridiculous, or that they're all incipient terrorists and have to be, you know, molded into good citizens whether they want to be or not. It's an impossible situation. Handing over your kid to a public school is fueled by a bunch of politicians who are only interested in getting reelected to fatten their own purse strings, bureaucrats who are only interested in punching the clock so they can buy into some nice, healthy retirements that they don't have to pay for, and an idiotic collection of liberal-minded, utopia-seeking college professors who are training teachers not to know anything about their subject to be incredibly politically correct when they teach it. The whole system has gone to the hot place in the handbasket. And it won't change unless we change who's running this country. We get back to the fact that we're running it, and people don't get reelected for 35 to 40 years until they're senile enough to think that if we put more troops on Guam, the island will sink.
I remember that. And, you know, you're absolutely right, because it's the same ideology, okay, and going all the way back to when we started the Lieber Code and the first Geneva Conventions, trying to establish international rules of warfare. And I mean, it goes back well beyond that. I mean, they're obviously, you know, the rules used to be you lined up like gentlemen and shot each other until somebody surrendered.
And that's it.
And we don't see the insanity of it.
No, we don't. And given the fact that I don't like labels very much, so I don't call myself anything particular other than a human being, female, and somebody who is driven by whatever to teach. Those are about the only labels that fit. I get tired of the political parties. I get tired of the ideological say-nothing messages. I'm seeing some pretty good messages from the Republican Party right now, but I still am not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat, God forbid. If anything, I'm closer to a libertarian in my views than anything else, but I'm not a member of that party either. I'm what they call a conservative independent. And I think that we need to get away from the idea that some group of people, whether it's a public school, a political party, a Congress, or whatever, knows better than we do what our life has taught us and what we should do with those life lessons. In general, I do believe in natural selection, in the sense that if you're stupid enough to light a match as you're pouring gas into your tank, then I'm glad you're going to suffer immediate death so you can't breed any more idiots who will light a match when I'm pouring gasoline in my tank. I know that sounds mean and cruel and horrible, okay? I'm mean and cruel and horrible. But in general, what we've got now is we've got a nanny state that spends all of its attention and all of its money and all of its compassion on people who contribute less than nothing to society.
Oh, certainly. And the ones that are not even here on this continent that they deem to be contributing less to society, they want to go and enlighten them and bring them the industrial age to their countries through this monstrosity they've created called the United Nations.
And we
have this grand utopian ideology that if we could just get everyone to be productive consumers and producers that will all hold hands and sing Kumbaya, that's a bunch of crap. And it drives me absolutely insane. I don't know why people cannot understand that there are two purposes to have a strong military, and only two that are proper, in my view. One is as a deterrent to others to dissuade them from trying to raid our cupboard, the continent that we currently hold, and the other is to retaliate should they decide to do so.
I agree completely. That's the purpose of the military, according to our Constitution, for God's sake. the founding fathers really didn't want a standing army, because at the time that they created our nation, standing armies were means of basically enslaving them. The British
tyranny.
Army was, yeah, it was tyranny, imposition of tyranny. But they did not want to be at the mercy of everybody. They saw the best way to keep international relations fairly comfortable was through trade. A trading partner with all, friend or enemy to none. And it was a sensible, common sense way to proceed in a brand new nation that just by the help of God had defeated one of the greatest military powers ever seen in history, and we still don't know how the hell they did it. We need to recognize, as you do, that there are only two purposes for a military. One is to deter aggression from greedy states, and the other is to defend ourselves if they should become aggressive. We should not be in the business of exporting our way of life other than by example. We aren't missionaries, damn it. I'm sorry, I don't have a lot of respect for missionaries. And I don't want my country to be one. 9 times out of 10, a missionary winds up with a room full of rice Christians who blithely go back beating their wives and beating their children the minute the missionary's back is turned. And that describes Afghanistan pretty doggone well. We are not going to be able to export our way of life. The only thing we can be is that example, that shining city on the hill. We're the only country in the world that I know of that people try to break into. And we have been for over 150 years. We didn't get that way by running around and fighting everybody else's wars. We got that way because we had a society in which little men were not artificially elevated to great positions, and great men were not artificially squashed out of envy, spite, and jealousy. Unfortunately, what we have now is an administration who wants to squash great men out of envy, spite, and jealousy because the head of it has no concept of what it means to be an individual and rise by your own merits. We don't teach that in our schools. We don't act that in our policies. We do not respect the idea that the individual entrepreneurial spirit, the human spirit to try to make tomorrow better than today, is what has made us great. It isn't our natural resources alone. It isn't our constitution per se. It isn't our incredible ethnic mix. It's many of those things combined and following that ideal that the individual is the mover and shaker and the creative idea. And if we don't give the people in this nation the belief that that's what they have the freedom to do, we will die as a country. We will die as a culture. We will die as individuals and as groups.
Well, I agree, and I think we're witnessing the death of the American ideal right now, and have been. Thank God there is a resurgence, a group of people that have gotten off of their butts, decided to get educated, and try to understand why. And, you know, if you look throughout history, just our nation, our history right here in this country, I would like to find the individual that coined the idea of civilization, dig up his bones, and burn it.
Because I'll help you.
In God's honest truth, that word, you know, you go back through history, the savages, like the Indians, are the ones who fiercely fought to keep their independence and not be ruled over by the civilized societal class of learned gentlemen. And we see the same thing. I mean, it's been going on for centuries.
You
would think sooner or later we'd get the idea this is not working, guys.
Well, it's the idiocy of a multiculturalist, which is not a moron itself. You can't have that. It's not possible. You either live within a culture or you leave it and find a culture in which you're comfortable. You don't bring your culture somewhere else and expect the culture there to adapt and add it to theirs. It's a stupid idea. There's an assumption, Ron, that I have seen in the way we teach our kids and in the way our politicians have fallen in love with political correctness, that we don't have a culture of our own. And we do. We have a very vigorous, lively, achieving culture, and have had for over 200 years. But multiculturalism, in their view, is just basically, oh, here's a nice new weapon to slip in their back when they're not looking to kill it. You can't have multiculturalism or one world order or any of the other utopian idiocies that these people keep trying to promote. It cannot be done with being human beings. You can do it with machines, you can do it with computers, you can do it with robots, and you can do it with ants, but not real people.
Yeah, and the best way to avoid that situation is don't mess with everybody else.
Exactly.
And
let
if they mess
culture,
with you, kick their butts.
Uh-huh. Evolve all you want on your own ground. Just don't come here and decide you're going to change my evolution. It's nobody's business what Afghanis do in Afghanistan except Afghanis. Now, if they decide to row over or paddle over or ride their horse across the Atlantic and shoot me, I'm going to shoot back. Otherwise, I don't care.
Precisely. You know, we look at, and I wanted to tell this guy, but I couldn't go any further. You know, I remember when the Berlin Wall fell.
Okay? I do, vividly.
And the headlines, communism is defeated, communism is dead. Is it really? We look at the situation in the Middle East right now, and what's the biggest deterrent, what has been the biggest deterrent to both the United States and Israel against attacking any of the Muslim hordes over there in the Middle East, it's been China and Russia. Well, I thought communism was dead. I thought we defeated that. See, it didn't work out the way they had envisioned.
It still exists. Well, this part of, it kind of all comes back to the basic understanding of people, culture, and the things interact and how they affect everything from foreign policy to how to raise our kids. In human beings see things through their individual life experiences and the culture in which they grow up. All you have to do to really understand this is to look at things, something as simple as food prejudices. In Arabic tribal culture, if you are a guest in a sheikh's tent, and an honored guest, you are offered the eye of the roasted sheep as a mark of honor. And should you refuse it, the sheikh will be terribly insulted and feel that you are downgrading him and making him lose faith in the next 150 years. Well, I don't really want to eat a sheep eye. Now, if you have something that simple that can create an, in effect, diplomatic incident leading to war, what in the name of heaven thinks you makes anybody think that they can go into another culture and arbitrarily redesign it simply because they have more advanced technology? We did it to the Indians. That wasn't right either. Now we're busily doing it to everybody. There's a difference between believing in the good things about one's nation and in deciding that you have a mandate from God to go force your culture on everybody in sight. I don't believe we do. I don't believe that was what the founding fathers expected either. Just from their writings and from the way they crafted the bones of our country, the way they built in to our founding document the idea that we were concerned with making our nation work according to the principles set forth in the Declaration of Independence and preamble to the Constitution. We were not setting ourselves up as a missionary to the entire world. And I don't know other than Teddy Roosevelt, prior to Teddy Roosevelt, it didn't happen internationally. prior to him, it happened nationally with Andrew Jackson and his incredible war against anything that was Native American. But
yep.
It's this screwball manifest destiny thing that we've never gotten over. It underlies our culture. There's always the idea that somehow or other we are going to be able to make the world over into our own image. And that was not, to my understanding, that was not the Founding Fathers' vision at all. Looks like I've got another caller on the line. Hang on, Ron. We'll see who else wants to join the conversations tonight. Hello there.
Can you hear me?
I sure can, Miss Linda. How are you tonight?
Hi, Ron, Terry, everyone in the chat room. It's funny when you talk about the multiculturalism. See how well it's worked out for the south of France when you can't even get into your homes and your shops because of the Muslims praying in the streets. It's lovely.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, in California, we have the same problem here because, you know, they want to reconquista the whole dang state. But it's amazing how the progressives think, and Andrew Jackson was another one we should dig up and kill again. But we've got a whole list of those guys. And what I did on my show, and what I talked a little bit about on, I think Ron's show, but I can't remember how far back was gone, one day blends into the next with all this news. We keep getting bombarded with the political rhetoric and the idiot pundits, and, oh, my head will explode with these people, and especially with the debates of the liberals versus the so-called conservatives. But I'm reading, and I get on my knees every day and thank God for the parents that I had so that I was taught how to think, because I'd never get through this book, and it's Road to Serfdom by Hayek. And I'm just in the middle, in the very beginning of it, but it is fascinating. And it's giving me a real good insight as to how he was thinking and why and what was going on at that period and where he came from. And, you know, monetary system, psychology of ideologies and things like that. It's fascinating. Again, it's a tough read, but I love it. So I'm hooked.
Well,
I'm hooked.
Liz, my dear girl, my favorite heroine, and Ron, my dear friend, my favorite hero, one of many, both of you are lifelong learners. Every single member of our Patriot family is a lifelong learner. We are all intensely curious. We want to know. This is what this nation wanted, what our founding fathers wanted our kids to be like. That's why they advocated public education. They understood that opening a mind to learning was what was going to make us succeed. And we are doing the opposite now.
Yep.
It comes back to... You know, I bring it back to education because that's, to my mind, even though it gets ignored and glossed over and let's throw more money at it and it'll be fine, it is at the root of our problem because this garbage has been going on in our public schools, which educates the vast majority of our future voters for the last 35 years. And who was it who elected the thing in the White House?
Those are the ones. That's the demographic age group that you're speaking of. Absolutely.
It sure as heck wasn't my age group or yours or Ron's.
Yep, I know.
You got that right.
And you can't overemphasize the importance of what's happening to us as a culture with what these people are doing in our educational system. You don't a viable, living, creative society when you train its children to be complacent victims dependent upon government. And that is what we are doing. I have watched this go on. I have spoken about it, not necessarily on the radio or on the internet for 35 years because I didn't learn how to use the internet until about 15 years ago. But in my discussions with fellow human beings, I always believed and tried to express the belief that what mattered was the desire to learn, because the desire to learn something new fuels everything. It fuels capitalism. It fuels invention. It fuels the improvements in technology that have brought our world so close Afghanistan is a phone call away, for heaven's sake. None of that would happen without people who want to learn, who want to experiment, who want to try something different. Educating your population to be complacent and accept whatever government tells them is a death sentence.
Right, and the education also sparks the imagination of a young one. And when you think about what progressives want to do, they want to turn everyone into the happy little mushrooms, which are being then
quietly
decayed upon by the elite.
Yes. We're all precious little truffles waiting our turn to be rooted up by a pig and served at the White House. I'm sorry.
Exactly.
I can't help it. Now, my brother-in-law says I always talk in parables. I always use imagery to teach, and it's the way my mind works. So you all are kind of stuck with it. Bless your hearts. You keep listening. So why, I don't know, but I thank you all for it.
We love it.
I guess what really gets my passion aroused is understanding the incredible wealth, and I don't just mean financial wealth, the wealth that's inherent in the human spirit. And as a teacher and as a person who has enjoyed spending that wealth my entire life, it breaks my heart to see young minds being squished, pummeled, and crammed into little boxes so that they'll behave quietly and do what they're told and follow leaders who are taking directly the perdition. It literally breaks my heart. I do the little tiny bit I can.
Yes.
I don't teach political ideology because that's not my job. I am not a political science teacher, nor am I a government teacher. I am a humble paraprofessional who handles kids who can't behave in school. But I'm also a thinking, learning being. And the only way that I know to teach children about what makes learning desirable is to show that it's desirable to me and encourage them to ask the questions and get answers and find answers if I don't have one, or I'll find them. It's about learning facts, yes. It's about learning procedures, yes. But it's also about thinking for oneself and understanding that not everybody is always going to agree with you. And if they don't, it doesn't mean they hate you, they're a racist, they want to kill you, they're a terrorist, or any of the other tags the current left put on anybody who disagrees with them. The combination of political correctness and watered down special education-run public schools is going to and has created the monstrosity that is our current government. And if we don't put a stop to it by changing it, by the people we put in power to make the policy and to enforce it, we are SOL. We are gone. We are not going to be able to leave to our grandchildren the nation that we knew.
Right. You know, Terry, when you talk about the kids, I think one of the, like, especially young ones, the little ones, the most, I think, the best way to get them to want to learn, I believe, at the younger ages, is to show them, in whatever way possible, that learning something can bring pleasure to oneself.
Exactly.
Because that's how they think. You know, that's how kids, they're emotional little beings, you know, and they learn by experience, and they're growing every second, and their hormones are going to change soon, and, you know, and their minds are just, they're grasping. And that's how they perceive the world. What makes me happy and what makes me smile and what makes me comfortable, because that's how they're nurtured from small. So if you can do that, or any teacher can do that, that would be a feather in one's cap, because they'll take that and they'll love it, and they will have the thirst for the knowledge.
That's just my
humble opinion. Huh?
I remember years back they started this learning is fun thing. And unfortunately, like any other idea, it went completely off the rails to the point where it now means that if you're not having fun, you must not be learning anything, which is the essential stupidity of progressives. But something that I do that goes along those lines, Linda, that you were talking about, of some enjoyment in the act of learning things.
Right.
Every once in a while, if I have a fairly large crowd of prisoners in my jail on a Friday, at the end of the day, I will engage them in an academic scavenger hunt. I'll write up four or five questions on the blackboard in my room, or the whiteboard, since I got a new one. Well, a used one, but, you know, I'm last on the list or something like that. Four or five questions, and then tell them that the first person who gets all of them answered correctly will win a prize, and they are allowed to look in any book I have in the room. It's amazing how much fun they have. They really do enjoy it. And it's not, it does, the one aspect is that it makes a game. It makes learning like a game, and they're all addicted to games. And it also introduces the idea of real competition. I don't believe in everybody gets a trophy. Everybody doesn't get the prize. I'm sorry. Because in the real world, you're not always going to get the trophy. And I'm not trying to be cruel, and I'm not trying to make the little devils cry. I am merely trying to illustrate to them that sometimes you won't win. I was taught that. My mother used to let me and my sisters win at card games, mainly because she lost patience with us sitting there gibble-gabbling. My father would have cut off his hand before he did that, because he wanted us to learn how to both win and lose gracefully and learn
and
from the experiences.
Yeah.
And competition, the idea that you're going to be measured against someone else. We're teaching our kids in schools that nobody's going to measure you against anybody else. You're unique. You're an individual. You're wonderful in everything you do. And you don't have to measure yourself against this guy or that guy or that standard. And yet, they're running around demanding that every state set up a core of standards. And if they don't, the federal government is going to push one down their throat. It doesn't make any sense. It can't be done. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't have night and day at the same time. You can't have everybody achieves at the same rate and everybody learns individually at their own pace. The two things are totally incompatible. And yet this is what teachers are being asked to do. Is it any wonder that good teachers can't stay in the system for longer than about 5 years?
I agree.
What are we left with?
You know,
we're left.
I know
the New York Rubber Room teachers.
Right here in Georgia, Georgia has been fighting very hard, our state legislature, to change the way they approach public education. And one of the bills that is circulating right now is to allow parents to have vouchers for what are called charter schools. And some of those charter schools may not even be in the state of Georgia, because some people live near the state line. You see, and so it may be more convenient for them to take their children across the state line to Alabama or Florida or one of the neighboring states.
Tennessee.
And we had a Democrat politician actually get up and give a speech on our House floor at how detrimental this will be to the poor districts. And how it will negatively impact these poor districts, because the school districts that suck and are in poor neighborhoods where their level of attendance is very poor, the home unit is very poor, the few students that do attend, their parents are probably going to send them to a better school where they can actually get a damned education. And what will they do with all the money they've lost for that district?
Oh, God.
So it is. It's not about educating the children. It's about keeping the damn money and the status quo.
Yes, sir. And it's about teachers' unions and their power to influence politicians. Unionizing teaching was one of the biggest mistakes that the states have made.
Never.
Thank God Virginia's a right-to-work state. I say that on my knees every day. I truly do. because I could not stand to live in a unionized state. Look at what's happening with all of the states, with their government unions, government employee unions. They are all going freaking bankrupt because they can't meet their obligations.
And you know what kills me, Terry, and I've talked about this on my show and on Linda's show, is that if you go in, okay, if you go into these school districts and into these states, and if you look at their comprehensive annual financial reports, okay, these school districts that are starved for money have billions of dollars. It's just not on the budget because it's been set aside their pension programs. So they have millions and millions of dollars in their pension fund that invests in corporations, companies, but they can't reallocate that money into the general fund. So while the school district may be suffering a shortfall in their budget, they have millions of excess dollars that are not required to pay out the current pension payments because they use two different accounting methods. Okay, one is actuarial and one is accrual method. And one makes projections based on percentage of growth and this kind of thing into the future. You see, so they have to pad that pension fund to make sure they have coverage 10 years from now when the teachers will be making $1 million a year on their pension, which never comes to fruition.
Yeah,
and it's infuriating. So it's kind of like being a drowning man in the ocean, you know? Water, water everywhere and not a drop
and
to
not
drink. Money everywhere, but not a drop for the budget because it's all going into these funds that they can't touch. It's insanity.
It's crazy. It's completely crazy. And the idea of the other thing that's completely insane is when you have government employee unions funding the people who decide what they're going to get paid, how does that make any sense? You know, I don't pay the boss's salary in a private business, okay? I can see a reason, and I understood the reason for unionizing in the 19th century because there was a lot of exploitation going on of the working man. And I come from working man roots. But when unions, like anything else, fell into the power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely trap, we are in the same boat as we were with the tycoons who didn't give a rat's behind and starved their workers and threw them out if they got a hangnail and whatever. We've just traded one slave master for another.
Yep.
And, you know, that idiot vice president and his happy little chains remark, it isn't Wall Street that puts chains on us. It's government. If you
want to look for
who's reinstituting Jim Crow, look at the latest executive order about recruiting black teachers to teach black kids.
Oh, my God. It's insane.
You look at that. You look at that and you tell me that this is not a divisive president, as he swears up and down he isn't.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I swear, poor Dr. King has got to be looking like a whirling dervish under the ground or wherever he is by now. If anybody could have perverted his dream any more than the thing we have now, I can't believe it. I really can't. The post I can come is Heinlein's Farnham's Freehold. If you've never read it, do. I won't go into details about it, but if you've never read it, get a copy. It's been out of print forever. It's politically incorrect as all get out, but read it anyway. Right? So,
it is absolutely infuriating. I put in the chat room, it's reverse slavery. They get all the benefits while we do all the work.
That's pretty much it, yeah. And, you should have heard the outcry at the teachers' meeting that we had in our school last year when we were told that we were going to have to contribute a grand total of 2% to our own retirement. Oh, how horrible!
Yeah. Oh, my God.
You know, like I'm going to complain? I worked for government my whole life up until 5 years ago. I didn't expect my employer to provide my retirement all by himself. I contributed to it. I set aside money myself in an IRA. The fact that I no longer have it was a combination of a lot of circumstances and basically would have cost me my husband and didn't, thank God. So I'm not regretting that it isn't there anymore. Believe me, I'd rather have him. Yeah, he may not be gold and shiny, but I think he's beautiful. Anyhow, the idea that somehow or other we are supposed to hand over every choice we possibly could have to our benevolent government so that they can choose for us and protect us from ourselves and keep us safe and happy in the womb, an infant, prenatal, until we drop dead of boredom. Just is.
Well, this is what Ron Paul has talked about forever. He said, look, if you want to be the policeman of the world and you want a government that takes care of you from cradle to grave,
right,
then you have
don't
to have
here.
The income tax and the Federal Reserve System and don't change a damn thing.
Yeah,
exactly.
But if you want to be an independent individual that takes charge of your own life and is responsible for your own life choices, then you can't. We can't afford all this.
No, we can't. You simply cannot create prosperity by taxing
by
the
government
incentive
fiat.
Out of by or by taxing the incentives out of people who create things that give you prosperity.
Well, that's the
idea
thing. We've lost sight of the fact that government cannot give anything to anyone until it first takes it from someone else.
From somebody else, yes.
And it's
exactly
a reallocation.
Right.
It's a reallocation of assets, and it is seldom, if ever, a good reallocation of assets. That's why
exactly.
We see government typically fails at every endeavor they undertake.
They do.
Well,
because
theft.
You know.
And it's not only theft. Everything that I've seen government touch turns to merit. That's pretty much it from where I stand. And they're so good at it. And people keep saying that this president's a failure. In his mind, he's a success because he wants this destruction.
Of course he does.
I wish somebody would say it on the TV.
Yeah.
You know, I always go back to what to me has got to be the perfect example. And that is when our federal government took over a whorehouse and a saloon in Nevada for back taxes. And it went broke.
Yep. If you can't even run a brothel, how in the heck
right.
are you going to run a country?
If you can't sell booze and sex for a profit,
it's amazing. I mean, you know, even the lowliest little plumber or electrician gets a pretty girl to advertise for him. And believe me, if government can't sell the two things that are the most attractive things to 99% of male human beings out there, then we are definitely in deep trouble, folks. We really are. I mean,
my old boss used to have a great saying, you know, about we had a couple of guys that worked for us that just they had no ability whatsoever. And he would routinely say, you know, he couldn't sell sex on a troop transport.
That definitely describes somebody who is not cut out for sales. That's perfect. And that describes our government, because they couldn't either. I love it. I don't know whether I think you and Linda, Ron, were both listening last week when I did some of the quotes from The Economist. If the government was put in charge of the Sahara Desert, in 5 years there'd be a shortage of sand.
Yes.
Yes.
It's pretty much on the same line as you can't sell sex to a troop ship. Yeah, it works. And every single time government attempts to micromanage, everything goes to the hot place in a handbasket. Government, by its very nature, cannot micromanage anything. The only micromanagement that's viable is by an individual. I couldn't micromanage the people who worked for me when I was in a supervisor position. I had to train them and let them do the job and not stand over the shoulder and redirect them and correct them all the time. And then they weren't doing the job. I was doing it for them. That's what our current government wants to do. And it's partly one of the reasons I think that the individual who inhabits our house right now is so clueless is that he has never held a real job in his life, and neither has anyone that he looked to for guidance or mentorship. He does not understand what it means to actually work for a living for somebody who can fire you.
Yeah, everything's been handed to him his entire damn life.
Yes,
exactly. You're right.
He also does not understand what it means to be responsible for paychecks. My husband spent many a sleepless night worrying about meeting payroll for his employees, let alone himself. And if it was a choice between the employees and himself, the employees got paid and he didn't. This would be totally impossible for a current president to believe. He would assume and he would state flat out in front of the world that I was telling a lie, and I know for a fact I wasn't.
Correct.
He has no understanding of the fact that the vast majority of employers out there are perfectly ethical people. It is not unethical to desire to make a profit. Making a profit is a very ethical thing to strive for, because with a profit you can expand, you can hire more people, you can create more things that people have jobs that they earn money and will buy. It is not unethical to desire to make a profit. It is only unethical if your profit means more to you than your integrity. There are people for whom that's the case, and our president is one of them. His profit
is not necessarily monetary.
His profit is power.
Yeah. One of the reasons that Barack probably thinks all those things is he's probably never met an honest, ethical, non-crook business person in his life.
You're probably right there, Linda. I don't think he ever has. You know, the American black experience, which is being touted right now as the Barack Obamas and the Al Sharptons and the Jesse Jacksons and the Trayvon Martins and whoever else you want to pick. Why aren't they talking about the Alan Wests and the Condoleezza Rices and the Bill Cosbys?
Those are Uncle Tom's.
Oh, of course they are. They're tokens. Yeah. Uh-huh. The only way they have to maintain power is to create as many victims as possible, because that's their power base.
Yep.
If you're not a victim, you won't vote for them. And all they care about is getting reelected, holding on to the reins of power and the dollars that come with those reins of power. And I am not saying that is only on one side of the aisle, because there are plenty on the other side of the aisle who are in the business for the same reason and go with the wind in order to keep their power. My friend Bill in the chat room says, why don't they see the wisdom of Thomas Sowell? Because they're too stupid. They're too stupid.
True.
I'm sorry, but they are. Ignorance is curable. Stupidity is not. And stupidity does not necessarily match IQ number. Stupidity is pretty doggone close to the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result each time.
But I don't think they actually expect a different result. I think they recognize it. The pimps like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, they know damn good and well. They're not fooling me. They know damn good and well, and they know what side their bread is buttered on, and I'll be damned if they're going to let it go. I've said that a million times. And that's why these people start getting all pissy and uppity, and they want to riot, because they see the gravy train is fixing to pull out of the station, and they won't be on it.
Exactly.
Yep.
And, you know, we've got to stir up racial division. We've got to stir up the victims. We've got to get the mob psychology going, because only then can we maintain power. Because if they actually start to think, we've lost them.
Yep. And that's why we've always got to have a boogeyman. We always have to have a boogeyman somewhere over the water that can't reach us, but they might be able to. You know, and the evil Muslim hordes, and I don't agree with their theocratic ideology.
Neither do I.
I don't sit in my house and shudder in fear that they're going to come, you know, in my home, although my government is making it much easier for them to do that by not enforcing our laws and keeping our damn borders wide open.
Exactly. if that's probably underlying why they're not, Ron. If you can make people afraid, in general, with a city mentality, you turn to government. Because the rural mentality, you don't. I mean, government can do everything it wants. It's not going to make that corn plant grow any faster. I'm sorry. Stick a seed in the ground, government can't turn it into Jack and the Beanstalk. It's going to take time to grow. Those who live outside of cities are used to the idea that if something breaks, you do your best to fix it yourself, because it may not be the guy three doors down or three blocks over who can come and fix it when you pick up your cell and call it. It's a different kind of mindset. There is a commercial running in Virginia for our current president's reelection campaign about how much he really believes in rural values. Every time I hear it, I go for the bathroom in order to put my head in the convenience, because everything comes up. I try not to eat when the radio is on, simply because I know darn good and well that he has no clue what a rural value is. He wouldn't recognize one if it walked up and licked him in the face. He has no clue what real rural values are. If you look at the map in the 2008 election, and you look at the red states versus the blue states, and you look at the population concentrations in the blue states, You can see flat out that the rural value that he says he espouses, the people who actually espouse them could have him in preference to the people. It's obvious.
Right.
It's obvious. And yet this inability to understand that people, the vast majority of our nation, are not as stupid as he wants to believe they are. And they are not as gutless as he wants to believe they are.
Amen.
It just,
you know, the Quisling media are soon finding out that not only will they be out of business, they're the only ones that are going to be those happy little mushrooms that get defecated on daily.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty soon, because we're wising up to it. Absolutely.
Yep. Yes, we are, thank God. And, you know, there's something about, there was an op-ed piece that Lamarcus wrote that somebody sent me a link to, I don't know, talking about the but God aspect of his life. And he didn't go into details, but it was basically a very optimistic piece, in the sense that every time, and I'm paraphrasing, that he thought that the world was coming to an end, his personal world, and that things couldn't possibly improve, then something stepped in and there was a way. The idea of if God closes a door, he opens a window. The idea that the human spirit, with the aid of its spiritual connection, does rise. And we see that if we look at history. Every time someone has tried to redesign humanity and kill that human spirit, something has happened to make it stop. Like in the book that you finished, Seven Tipping Points. Something,
yes.
Whatever you call it, has occurred so that men of goodwill, if you will, do triumph. And that, I think, that's what we have to teach our kids at home first and always, and expect out of our educational system that understanding to be of goodwill does not mean to be a mindless robotic doormat. It means to do what is right instead of what is easy. If we could teach that along with the academics, we would continue to be the great nation that we are. If we can, and I believe we can, I believe we will, because there are enough folks out there like you, like Ron, like Bill, Hollis, all of the people that I talk with, my family reunion, my husband's nephew's new wife was kind of given a baptism of fire because she tends toward the liberal point of view, and she was in a hotbed of conservatives all weekend, poor thing. But she survived. Nobody bit her. And she said she enjoyed herself, so I don't know how true it was.
Oh.
But she gave me a big hug anyway, so yeah, and it felt true. But there are enough of us out there We are surrounding them. We are the majority. We are the culture of this nation. Not an unkind group of people who are so greedy that we don't care about one another. We're the most generous nation in the world. You look at Glenn Beck's Restoring Love event. Something like that has never happened just on the plea of a host before. The thousands and thousands of people who went out to support the CEO of Chick-fil-A's right to his religious beliefs and his right to speak them in public. Not his right to have everybody go to his restaurant, his right to say what he believed and take whatever consequences, good or bad, come from it. That's what we're supposed to be teaching along with the academics. Not political correctness, not multiculturalism, not feel-good philosophy of, oh, gee, you're perfect just the way you are, not ridiculous expectations that can't be met, punishing good teachers for not being able to work miracles. It has to change, and I think it's changing. The number of states that are putting in voucher systems, the incredible rise in people who are homeschooling, not only for religious reasons, but simply because some of them are scared to death to let their kids go into some of these inner-city schools. And even our ideological idiot in the White House backed down from closing off the D.C. voucher program as he intended to do.
Mm.
There was enough publicity about the fact that the kids who took part in it had something like a 98% graduation rate versus the 35% graduation of the D.C. public schools.
Wow.
Now, it's... We have to take our country back into our own hands, as our founding fathers intended us to do. If we go back to first causes, as my husband is very fond of, if we go back to the founding documents, the Constitution, and the reasons why it was crafted the way it was, with its first 10 amendments only, to understand, read it, and understand why they wrote it that way. What were they looking at? They were not looking at utopia. I don't think any of them believed it could exist this side of heaven. And they were correct.
Right.
It can't. But they were looking to create a chance to make things better for everybody based on each individual's abilities, skills, drive, effort, and talent. And that is true freedom. True freedom is not everybody gets a trophy or a level playing field or any of the other feel-good, semi-compassionate garbage that the progressive left dumps on us. That's not freedom.
No.
It's not. It's the freedom to say, yes, sir, is about it. It's the end.
How much time do you have? I'm going to let you wind it up and go back to the chat room. And great chatting with both of you, Ron and Terry, and everyone in the chat room. And God bless you. And it was great today. Thank you.
Thank you for calling in, Linda, as always. Bless you, dear heart. Have a great evening. We've got a little over 7 minutes left, ladies and gentlemen. And I would urge you all, as I have said before, get involved in the public school system in your hometown, in your home county, in your city. Go to the school board meetings. Pay attention to your kids and grandkids and nieces and nephews' syllabuses. What are they learning? Don't assume that the teacher has the ultimate responsibility for making them want to learn. You bear a responsibility as a parent, as a grandparent, as an aunt, as an uncle, as a neighbor, and as a friend. You live the lifelong learner mentality, and it will be seen and copied. Because when you live it, every day is the potential for a delight. Live the ideal on which the nation was founded. Not its mistakes. Don't gnaw old bones in the dark. Don't go back over all the bad things we did as a nation. Look at the fact that we changed them, that we didn't keep doing them to this day. There is no slavery in the United States allowed by law. There are no restrictions as to a woman's right to vote or own property or choose her own career. We no longer shoot Native Americans. We just put them on reservations and give them a bottle of alcohol, which I guess is a slightly kinder death. But we try, as a culture, to fix what's wrong. Not by taking away choice. but by increasing choice. Taking away choice doesn't make things better. It makes things infinitely worse. We cannot allow ourselves to believe that there is no hope for tomorrow, other than complacent clonehood. And we cannot allow our children to be taught this pernicious idea. We have to step up and take charge. We have to remember that if we give our best effort and don't succeed the first time, then we pull a little more effort and maybe we'll succeed the next. And we have to teach our kids this by precept and by example. Not that they're entitled to anything, but that they have the opportunity for everything. If I were running for office, that would be my political slogan. You're not entitled to anything, but you have the opportunity for everything. That is the fundamental idea upon which this nation was founded. And in my heart, and in my mind, and in my spirit, I believe that it is a good idea, a positive idea, that has changed the world in many ways for the better and will continue to do so if we just believe it and live it and teach it to our children inside the classroom and out. If we do this, ladies and gentlemen, every single one of us can be the pebble that starts the avalanche. And I believe that avalanche has been started. I believe, because I must believe, that the human spirit and the desire for liberty will triumph. We may go through difficult times, we most likely will. We may get frustrated and want to scream at our political leaders, both in person and when we hear them pontificating on our televisions, our radios, our smartphones, our computers, and whatever else we use. But we are created in the image of our Creator, and that means we're creators too. We can create a better world, not by imagining that we can make it perfect, but by believing that we can make it better. Not by forcing our way on someone else, demanding that our culture adapt to every other culture so it no longer exists as a culture at all, but by being the very best individual we can be, paying attention to who we put in office to quote-unquote lead us, make our laws, enforce our laws, create the policies by which our businesses and institutions function, including our education system. We are responsible, ladies and gentlemen. We are responsible for ourselves as individuals, and we are responsible for our government because we have given our consent. We pull that lever or push that button or poke the screen with our finger. We are showing the consent of the government. This is what the Declaration of Independence said gives government its power. Be careful what you consent to. We have a contract, an unwritten contract, with those who represent us. If they default on their contract, then we need to fire them. To pay attention to what we are consenting to. We need to teach our children that they are responsible for their own choices and their own actions. We need to teach them that the only stupid question is the one you don't ask. We need to teach them that thinking and learning are enjoyable and necessary for their own sake, and we need to teach them the ethics and morality they need to use what they have thought and what they have learned in ways that benefit themselves and others, and things that don't break my arm or pick my pocket. We need to pay attention to the fact that we were a nation built on the principles that are in the Ten Commandments, whether you are a Christian or not. They are just as viable as a symbol of law as the tablet, the Code of Hammurabi, or the Roman law that actually was the first real codification so that the average citizen understood his responsibilities under law. Thank you for being with us tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Please join us every night of the week for a show from Patriot Families. Visit our website, www.patriotfamilies.com. Share your opinions, your ideas, your complaints, your frustrations, and your hopes with folks who believe in this nation and everything it stands for. Good night, everyone. See you next week.